Now, I wonder if you would turn with me in your Bible, and you'll find a Bible underneath the seat in front of you or somewhere else close at hand. Turn to the beginning of John's Gospel in the New Testament, John chapter 1, and we're going to read from verses 14 to 18 on page 116 or 117 of the New Testament of the Bible. John's Gospel, chapter 1, from verse 14. And this is really John's version of the Christmas story. It doesn't include any shepherds, or angels, or wise men, or Mary's or Joseph's, but it does include the most important character in the Christmas story. And I guess in some ways, if Matthew's and Luke's versions are an account of what happened, then you could say this is an account of why it happened. It begins with the words that are probably familiar to many of us in chapter 1, verse 1, where it says, "In the beginning, the Word already existed. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. And from the very beginning, the Word was with God." And then when we pick up the story in verse 14 this morning, it becomes very obvious to those who know anything about the Christian story, becomes very obvious who the Word is. Because it says in verse 14, the Word became a human being, or literally, the Word became flesh, and full of grace and truth lived among us. We saw his glory, the glory which he received as the Father's only Son. John the Baptist spoke about him. He cried out, "This is the one I was talking about when I said, 'He comes after me, but is greater than I am, because he existed before I was born.' Out of the fullness of his grace, he has blessed us all, giving us one blessing after another. God gave the law through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but the only Son, who is the same as God and is at the Father's side, he has made him known." The Word became a human being and lived among us. But I want to think, first of all, about this Word that John has given us. The Word, who of course is Jesus Christ, the Word became a human being and lived among us. But that word lived means literally something slightly different. It was an expression which John picked up and used, and it's probably quite right to translate it the way that it has been translated, but it could also be said the Word became a human being and pitched his tent among us, because that's the literal expression that John used, or at least what is implied in the meaning of the word. And I think there are two significant reasons for using that expression. The Word, Jesus Christ, pitched his tent among us. And the first of them is this, that tent pitching is temporary. You put your tent up at night, you sleep in it overnight if you're very lucky, and you strike your tent in the morning. If you're absolutely pushed, you might leave your tent up and camp in it for a whole weekend. And if you're completely mad, you might do it for a fortnight's holiday. But if you were to stay in a place for any longer than that, then surely you would start looking for a more permanent base, because tent pitching is temporary. And for that reason, it seems a strange expression to use of Jesus, because he was here on earth for the long haul, was he not? We don't know that he ever did sleep in a tent. There's no suggestion that he ever did. But we do know that after the Bethlehem stable, he had a childhood in Egypt for 2 years, and then in Nazareth, an adolescence and probably a career for 15 years or more as a carpenter around Galilee. And then at the age of 30, he embarked on a 3-year-long public ministry. So while the length of his life was not perhaps long by our standards, and indeed was cruelly cut short, as we know, Nevertheless, you could hardly say that he was just passing through or on a flying visit. So why then does John say that he came and pitched his tent among us? Well, there's a clue perhaps in another verse of the Bible. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1, Paul is writing, and he says there, "We know that when this tent we live in is torn down, God will have a house in heaven for us." But he inserts another few words. "When we know this tent we live in, our body here on earth is torn down, God will have a house in heaven for us to live in." So Paul thought of his own body as a tent that he lived in, a temporary dwelling place for the world that he was passing through on his way to heaven. And it seems likely that is the sense in which John is speaking of Jesus as a tent picture here. Not that his life on earth was less settled or less permanent than anybody else's was, but that all human life on earth is no longer lasting or permanent than his was. We are all just passing through. So the Apostle John, as he introduces Jesus to the world, starts off by setting out a time scale for his life on earth, saying Jesus has not come to provide an everlasting solution to the problems that we face today, for the simple reason that life on earth itself is not an everlasting thing. He did come to pitch his tent for a purpose, and he is a problem solver, says John, but the everlasting solution that he provides is not in this place that we're all passing through. And that's why the famous Christmas carol, "Away in a Manger," finishes off by saying, not that Jesus came to fit himself for earth, to live with us here, although you might have thought that from the fact that God became a human being, but finishes off by saying that he came to fit us for heaven, to live with him there. Now, it was the Word who became a human being and pitched his tent among us. And a word is a means of communication. You speak a word when you've got something to say, something for us to listen to. In this case, a message from God. But if this word is spoken to us from a tent pitched among our tents, in a place that we're all passing through together on a way to somewhere permanent, then it's bound to be a word about where we are going. Think of the guide on a tour bus. A number of years ago, when I had the privilege of visiting India, we were taken on a bus to visit the Taj Mahal, and it was about 4 hours bus drive from the hotel we were staying to this magnificent, one of the seven wonders of the world. What were the words from the tour guide which mattered while we were on that bus? Wasn't the words about making sure we fastened our seat belts or telling us whereabouts in the bus the toilets were. Those were words that were of value for the journey only, important in a sense, but not why we were there. The words that mattered were the tour guide's description of this wonder of the world that we were going to see, and more importantly, what he told us about how we were going to get into the Taj Mahal when we got there, where to collect our tickets and which gates to go through and all that kind of thing. Because there could have been nothing more frustrating than to have gone all the way to India and spent all those 4 hours on the bus in the heat of the day driving down and then to have got stuck in the car park and not to have seen that wonder of the world because we didn't know, because we hadn't heard how to get from the bus park to the site that was there to be seen. So here is Jesus passing through this life with us, pitching his tent among us as a word to us about where we are going. And it's as we look beyond this life and turn to him for guidance and instruction about what happens next that the word in our midst makes sense and is a word of lasting value. So tent pitching is temporary as God speaks to us about what lasts forever. But then a second thing, which is that tent pitching is reminiscent. Okay, if Jesus had come to stay with us today, then we might well have said something like, Jesus came and shared a flat with us. or roomed with us in halls, or lived up our close, or lived down our street, because that is the way that we live today. John said Jesus pitched his tent among us. And yet, so far as we know, not only did Jesus never live in a tent, but neither did any of his contemporaries, James or John or any of the others. But we do know that their ancestors did. Because during that foundational time for Israel of the Exodus from Egypt to the Promised Land, when Moses was there to lead the people and Aaron was ordained as the first high priest and the Ten Commandments were given on tablets of stone and the Ark of the Covenant was made and seen, these were the good old days for Israel, the time they looked back on with fond memories, their equivalent of Bannockburn or Trafalgar or D-Day or Independence Day or whatever. The days that perhaps Jewish children and their imaginations went back to when they played Let's Pretend. And during those days, they did live in tents and moved each day from place to place as God led them, with a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day. And back then, God pitched his tent among them. The tent of meeting that was there in the center of the camp, the place where sacrifices were offered and priests led the people in the worship of God. You might remember last Sunday we were reading in Leviticus about the ordination of the priests and the beginning of the use of that tent for worship. And we saw how Moses and Aaron went into the tent of the Lord's presence, and when they came out, the dazzling light of the Lord's presence appeared to all the people. And that was the climax of Jewish religious history. That was the high point of their relationship with God. No more glorious sight had ever been seen, and no greater reassurance of God's presence with them had ever been given. Until that day when the baby lay in a manger. And John was able to say, not we read in the ancient book of Leviticus about how the glory of the Lord appeared and shone, but is able to say in verse 14, we saw his glory. The glory he received as the Father's only Son. So you see what's happening. John is using language of Jesus coming to stay with us, which is reminiscent of the Exodus story. He takes us back to the most glorious event which has ever happened in the whole of history and says, what we have seen since is even greater still. And then he goes on to emphasize the point. Look at what it says in verse 16. Out of the fullness of his grace, he has blessed us all, giving us one blessing after another. Literally, he said, giving us one blessing to replace another. The presence of God in Jesus Christ, the Word become human, replacing the dazzling light of God's presence in the tent. In verse 17 it says, God gave the law through Moses. And what a wonderful law it was. So full of wise guidance and clear revelation and gracious provision for the problem of sin. But grace and truth, the new blessing that replaces the original blessing with something better still, grace and truth, came through Jesus Christ. In verse 18, no one has ever seen God. Even Moses, when he entered the tent of meeting, was not allowed to see God's face and live. And therefore, what Moses was able to share with the people was a glimpse of a shadow at second hand. But the only Son, the same as God, and at the Father's side, he has made him known. So now we have the most glorious revelation of it all. So that's the picture that John is painting, and at first sight it seems to be an impossible contrast with the story that we know from Matthew of Luke of shepherds and stables and mangers. It seems strange to say that the brightest thing ever, or the most glorious, was a baby in a food trough, or a Galilean peasant, or a convicted criminal. It's not surprising that some of them then, and some people now, still mock and revile and ignore him. But what John understood and is telling us here is that the glory is not in what was done. John wasn't saying, what a glorious manger we saw. It was better than any other manger we've ever seen before. Or what wonderful shepherds, my, how well they shepherded their sheep. That's not what he's saying at all. The glory is not in what was done, nor in what was suffered or endured. There's nothing glorious about mockery or whips or nails. The glory is in who it was that was willing to come and suffer and endure it all for us. So we look into the stable with John and up to the cross, and we glorify God because who we see there is God himself. And so we have these two things, that tent pitching is reminiscent of the best that there had ever been before, to say that what is in our midst now is even better. And that tent pitching is temporary, preparing us for the future we can share if we respond in faith to the word that pitched among us. And we need to hear that, and we need to see into that stable and see who it is that is there and pit it against the lives that we live by force of habit, that are rooted to the spot and that are anchored to the here and now, that are forgetful of the past and that are careless of the future. When our message to ourselves today is to say, give me what I want now, or hear what I have to say. And the real Christmas carol, if ever we sing it, says, glory to me on lowest earth, and hold your peace in heaven. Carols sung by disappointed and pessimistic people. And why are we like that, and what is wrong with us? Well, it is simply because we haven't seen his glory. We've only glanced at it and said, isn't that nice for the children? And then we've looked away to the things that matter and focused our hearts and minds upon the things of self and the things of now. And the message that John is drawing our attention to is one that simply says to us, look again at what we have seen. Because the Word became a human being and pitched his tent among us. The best that there has ever been is what we have seen. And he's here to tell us that the better still is still to come. And so I pray that God will bless to us his word at Christmas.